From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Apple enters the streaming wars, but can it really challenge Netflix and Amazon? Then TV producer Caroline Drees on the importance of creating a gay Batwoman.
I'm so proud and so excited about this as a fan to be making a show like this. And at the same time, I'm nostalgic and wishing that 13-year-old Caroline had this exact show, and a little bit jealous of now the 13-year-olds who get to watch it.
And Joshua Hami from Queens of the Stone Age returns to his desert home. All that coming up on The Frame. This Friday, Apple will launch its streaming service, Apple TV Plus, with four very expensive original shows. The tech giant isn't the only big name marching into the streaming battlefield. Next month, Disney will launch its own platform, Disney Plus. NBC and HBO both have plans to follow suit. Variety TV critic Caroline Framke checked out Apple's new series, and she gave me her download.
I've seen at least one episode of four shows launching the morning show, C, For All Mankind, and Dickinson, all of which have producers who have come from TV. They're not totally new. The morning show obviously features probably the buzziest stars, Reese Witherspoon, Steve Carell, and Jennifer Aniston, which is probably the biggest actor coup for any of the Apple shows coming, since this is Jennifer Aniston's first regular TV role since Friends.
Good morning. I'm bringing you some sad and upsetting news. And while I don't know the details of the allegations...
She's throwing me under the bus.
Mitch Kessler, my co-host and partner of 15 years, was fired today.
You know, C and For All Mankind are both alternate history shows, which I think is actually very interesting. C is an alternate future in which...
Almost all humans have lost the ability to see. Some say sight was taken from them by God to heal the earth.
For All Mankind is an alternate history of what if the Soviet Union made it to the moon first.
I thought it was about being first. Turns out the stakes are much bigger than that. Get back to work.
I think those are interesting concepts, but what they do with it isn't particularly interesting.
That was really striking to me in your reviews and in a two-way you had with one of your other Variety critics, is that you felt that they weren't daring, that given what else is out there on streaming services like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, that they weren't willing to go the extra mile and actually take a risk.
Yeah, and I think that they would obviously disagree with me. I think... The morning show in particular feels like it did belong on a network 6 years ago, despite it trying to sort of bring in timely elements. They obviously had to bring in some of Me Too. Dickinson sure is trying. For those who don't know, Dickinson is about Emily Dickinson, but it's about her as a feisty teenager, played by Hailee Steinfeld.
I have one purpose.
Wild nights.
And that is to become a great writer.
It definitely does a lot stylistically. It has a lot of, you know, bass-heavy rap music that comes in every so often. Death is played by Wiz Khalifa. It's very CW in the vein of Riverdale. But I do think, looking at the four shows overall, there's this weird sense I got that all these shows might have been more interesting if they came out 5 years ago. You know, they're all very shiny, expensive versions of things I feel like we've seen before that have been innovative previously, but in 2019, I don't know. I feel like I need a little bit more from them to really stand out when there are so many shows.
If you were to step back and say, this is clearly the market that Apple is going after, could you define what that audience might be?
I don't know that I can. And I say that because I'm not sure Apple can either. I think that this first slate of shows is a confusing one because they all seem to be sort of going for a different audience. Dickinson's kind of going for a CW teen thing. For All Mankind feels very AMC to me. Morning show, I think I said in my column, feels sort of ABC meets CBS All Access, question mark. And C is like a Game of Thrones that got lost. I just don't know what they were trying to do with the four of them combined. I think it feels like they were casting a wide net, and it just feels like some of these shows are kind of splitting the difference and not playing it very safe. They're not really taking a side, and maybe that felt safer for Apple, but it's not very interesting TV.
No, and one of the challenges for Apple is they don't have the library that, say, Netflix or Disney Plus has, so they really are making almost a pure play on these shows. And if they don't have a show that people have to watch, the question is, I guess, would people spend $5 a month just to watch Jennifer Aniston? And that seems to be the proposition, doesn't it?
The content library is a big part of streaming services, and I feel like Apple has kind of underestimated that. They, to their credit, are pricing it relatively low. $5 a month is definitely the lowest price by a pretty wide margin for any of the streaming services right now, though I believe that Disney Plus will not be much more expensive. And again, they have all these movies, all these other shows that will be available just for people to have. So even if you're not interested in one of the original shows, you're probably going to subscribe so you can watch all the Disney stuff.
Right. And that's the issue, right? Because even as people are cutting maybe their DirecTV subscription or their cable subscription, if you start doing a la carte pricing where you're getting Netflix, you're getting Amazon Prime, you're getting Hulu, you're getting Disney Plus, you know, a couple bucks here, pretty much you're back to 100 plus a month and you're right where you were before. So if you buy Apple sales pitch, what would be the argument for subscribing to Apple right now? Or maybe are there other shows that they're hoping will continue generating momentum and heat?
I have to imagine it's the latter, especially because they have been signing more and more overall deals with other creators for shows down the line. Alfonso Cuarón recently signed a TV deal, which I find very interesting. Jason Tatum from Friday Night Lights signed an overall deal there. And in general, these overall deals for creators like, you know, Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes, who went to Netflix, J.J. Abrams signed one with Warner Media recently, but Apple was courting all of them. You know, Apple knows that if it can get people to make shows that people might want to sign up for, then that's what they have to do. But a lot of it right now is a wait and see. And like you said, people are spending a fair amount of money on these streaming services now, and I'm not sure wait and see will work.
Caroline Framke is a TV critic at Variety. Caroline, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, the new Batwoman is unlike a lot of superheroes, and that's a true sign of progress. She's gay. There's a new Batwoman in Hollywood. Her name is Kate Kane, and she's bringing justice back to Gotham City in a new series on the CW network. Executive producer Caroline Drees recently stopped by to talk about the making of the series, and she said she was certain about one thing. Her title character simply had to be gay.
It was never a question. It was, of course, she's going to be gay. That's what makes her special. That is why we need to tell the story now. And nobody has questioned it at any level from DC, studio, network, any of the writers. It's just what makes the show what it is. So it was a no-brainer.
And I want to ask you about casting, because it's not just Batwoman. There are a lot of women who are in prominent roles of authority in this story.
Yes, that happened, I guess you could say, as naturally, or almost, I want to say, as a mistake. It's just what when you hire a woman who has some authority in the world to write these stories, she creates other women very naturally to exist in her world. So people have brought that to my attention. And then the first time they did, I was like, oh, I guess you're right about that. But that's why you hire strong women to write other women, is because that's what flows off their fingertips.
I want to play a clip, and this is where Kate, played by Ruby Rose, finds her bat suit for the first time. Luke Fox, played by Camris Johnson, is also in the scene.
I need you to fix his suit.
The suit is literal perfection.
It will be when it fits a woman.
It's a great suit. I want to ask you about its design, because it obviously references what we think that suit is going to look like, and yet it's definitely hers.
It's really a polarizing line. A lot of people reacted negatively to that because they don't want us reappropriating Batman's suit, which I understand. Today in the news, I was reading a story about two astronauts, two women, and it was supposed to be the first time that two women go out on a spacewalk together. And One of them had to be switched out for a man at the last minute because her suit literally didn't fit and they didn't have another women-sized suit. And that was so poignant to me because that's actually what I'm talking about. Is it's not that Batman wasn't great and that, you know, KK needs to step up and do his job for him. It's that the symbol of wearing this suit is what is really important, and that it's time that a woman is able to fit into the suit.
But it's also a symbol about young kids looking at a TV series and seeing somebody who looks like they might feel about themselves. And that was invisible 15 years ago, 10, maybe even 5. And I'm wondering, growing up yourself and about kids growing up today, how important it is to see somebody who thinks and behaves like you, even though they're a superhero, on screen, and what kind of comfort and validity that can give somebody watching.
Yeah, I'm so moved to think that it is providing comfort for people. It's this feeling that I can't even put into words of how surreal it is, thinking that this show is impacting some stranger in a city I've never been to. And it's just almost impossible to comprehend. And the only way I can relate to it emotionally is sort of this sense of wistfulness as I'm writing it. I'm so proud and so excited about this as a fan to be making a show like this. And at the same time, I'm nostalgic and wishing that 13-year-old Caroline had this exact show, and a little bit jealous of now the 13, you know, year olds who get to watch it.
We're talking with Caroline Drees about Batwoman. There's a scene in the first episode where two women kiss. And even when you have a gay or lesbian character in a TV series, what you see is often off screen, or it's alluded to, or you see them kind of hugging each other. But it felt very intentional on your part that we're actually see them make out.
Again, it was one of those things that I didn't even think about. It was just it's in the fabric of the show as I was writing it. Of course, the two love interests are going to kiss. For me, it's just an everyday part of my life, so I'm not really overanalyzing it like somebody might. But that's, I think, why, again, it's great to hire a lesbian to write lesbian characters, is it's not a thing.
I'm going to play another clip. This is where Kate is meeting the villain. His name is Alice, might be something else. We'll figure that out down the line. Who's played by Rachel Starsman?
We're all mad here. I'm mad, you're mad.
How do you know I'm mad?
You must be, or you wouldn't have come here. Very well, then. Off with her head.
It's impossible to watch this and not think a little bit about Joker or Mad Hatter. And I'm curious about the origin of the villain Alice and what you were thinking.
Alice is a character in the comic book Batwoman canon. So she is part of the reason I was drawn to the property. It's this really complicated, intense relationship that she has with Kate, very similar to the relationship that Batman has with the Joker. The difference here is that their relationship is a, you know, blood relationship. They're twins, which was revealed at the end of the pilot. It makes the story so much more complicated for Kate that she has all of these people in Gotham wanting Alice dead, and, well, it's her sister, and I can't let you do that.
And I think it's also important that Kate's former girlfriend is somebody who is, to this day, conflicted about what her heart tells her she should do.
Yes, I wanted to tell the sort of closeted story without it being, obviously, our central character. And I think Sophie's story was perfect for it because it's already been established a little bit in the comics. And what she goes through as not just a gay woman in the military, but as a Black woman, the pressures on her to succeed are unique and something I really wanted to explore.
Something I noticed today, and I don't know if you saw this story, you've been review bombed on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And that's not a good thing. I mean, I think that is people who are still uncomfortable with the idea of a lesbian superhero, and they have reviewed the show in disproportionate numbers based on what that kind of show would attract kind of numerically, and they've been very critical. So I guess that suggests that people are really somehow put off by the fact that Batwoman is gay.
it's striking. And for somebody like me and the group of writers and the execs and all the creative people involved in the show, we are in a bubble in Los Angeles where, you know, I'm sitting here and we're breaking stories about, oh, this gay element. And then I'm just like, does this sound like an after school special? Does this still happen? Like, do people still hate gay people? And then you see that and you're like, oh, yeah, this isn't just something that happened 20 years ago. This is happening 300 miles away. We're just in this bubble of privilege and luxury where we're not dealing with this right now. So it's just a constant reminder of the struggles that people are going through. And it's sad. And it just shows you why the show is so important.
How much, as a storyteller, are you governed by the rules of comics? And how much are you governed by the rules of television, having worked on shows like Vampire Diaries? That what can you do and what can't you do?
I was lucky with the Batwoman mythos. It kind of had a couple starts and stops over its history in the comics. And it's not one of those super familiar comics where, you know, everyone knows how Bruce Wayne's parents died and you don't want to mess with that origin story. With Batwoman, people aren't as familiar with it, so I can take these creative liberties left and right and nobody will really know the difference. And at the same time, I want to be reverent to the existing property, so I throw in a ton of Easter eggs that the diehards really notice and appreciate. So in terms of that, the studio and the network are really open to me doing whatever I want as long as it's a compelling, dramatic, emotional story.
We talked about the writer's room. We've talked about the cast. If I were to come visit the set, what would I see behind the camera? How have you tried to be representational about underrepresented people on the actual set and the physical production?
One thing that was really important, and it's really hard to do, is trying to pull in, you know, an equal amount of female leadership roles, trying to hire, you know, diverse department heads wherever you can. And it's just about taking those extra steps and interviewing a couple more people. And it's very hard, but we are trying.
You have, as any showrunner has, the pressure of creating a series and making sure that it succeeds. And then you have the added pressure of this iconic character being a lesbian woman. And can you separate one from the other? Do you feel any added pressure or responsibility to make sure that it works, comes around for another season?
Yeah, I felt a huge amount of pressure. A few weeks into breaking the first few episodes, I stopped the writer's room and I just looked at everyone and I said, you guys, is the show gay enough? Because I was reading all the press and everything is the first lesbian superhero, the first lesbian, you know, and I was just like, wait, that's what everyone's expecting. Like, is the show even, you know, gay? And everyone's like, yes, relax. She's in love with so-and-so. She's dating so-and-so. Like, it's so gay. And I just didn't realize it, you know, because I'm so in the trenches. And it's just, it's so, again, just part of Kate's everyday life is that she's attracted to women. And I'm forgetting that people, you know, maybe in a small town really see that as a gay storyline. But we don't tell a lot. We're not telling, quote unquote, gay storylines, but this is a character who happens to be gay and it is part of her everyday life.
Caroline Drees is the executive producer of Batwoman. It airs Sundays on the CW. Caroline, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next on The Frame, Joshua Hami from Queens of the Stone Age goes to the desert to quench his creative thirst. The musician and record producer Joshua Hami is from the desert east of L.A., and no matter what he's doing, that's his home base. And he does a lot of stuff. He's the front man for Queens of the Stone Age. He's also in Eagles of Death Metal. And Hami collaborates with lots of people outside those bands. Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, Iggy Pop, and even Elton John. Hami's latest project is a throwback to his communal instincts born in the desert of Joshua Tree more than 20 years ago.
My name is Joshua Hami. This is The Desert Sessions, Volume 11 and 12. There's no music school for people like me. It's all in the positive friction of collaboration that you learn things and kind of develop your communication skills. And I think I've always had an interest in seeing how other bands and other artists do their thing, you know? And so that's kind of how the Desert Sessions was born, to take people out to Joshua Tree, this studio called Rancho de la Luna, which is three houses on a property there, and improvise music together with people that do and mostly don't know each other. There's the gift of nothing out in the desert. I consider myself sort of lucky to have been born there. You're kind of dwarfed by the landscape. You know, when you get out there, there's no one there. It's done in secret. It's really a way to rekindle an early relationship with music and sort of ask, do you remember why you started playing? You know, someone has an idea and it triggers something in you, and you watch people say things like, oh, if we do this, then this. And that excitement is contagious. Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top. I've had the luxury of knowing Billy Gibbons for over a decade now. The song that he sings called Move Together, a friend that owns a studio, Dave, I said, hand me that looper. And it's just a little box. Turn it on and that's the loop that you hear. This kind of crippled atonal loop. And when I took it outside to Billy, he and I immediately, you could hear the melody and hear this thing. And he was saying, and you could sing this and maybe this lyric. And when he was all, he wrote the lyrics. And when he was done, I said, not me, you. You know? And he sang that vocal over just this loop.
She don't like my empty whiskey bottles. I don't like the smell of her hairspray.
And it was, what was wonderful is I look at Billy as a piece of art, and it was great to reframe him in a frame that was hand-built by these people out in the desert with love and care that is completely alien to how you would normally hear Billy. It is a really an intensely creative and talented list on this Desert Sessions. It's Libby Grace, who's a supremely talented country singer, but who has yet to ever play live or go out and record anything.
New age, burning of a page, a brand new dream to sail. Just as well.
There's something about moving at the speed of inspiration, and also there's three houses on this property, and you eat food together at the top one, and that walk between houses in the night, or you know, walking through the desert, creates this kind of staircase logic where you think of the answers. It's not the gear that solves problems or solves artistic Rubik's cubes. It's that walk when you're not playing and talking and thinking about what you've done out there. Matt Berry is an English treasure, an English comedian, actor, who's just wonderful.
Okay, so I'm here with John, who is the lead singer.
Josh.
Josh, who is the lead singer of the band Queens of the Stone Age. And this, I imagine, is where you record all of your music, is it?
Yeah, I'm most of the music.
I've got to say, some of the stuff looks. I mean, have you kept this for sort of, you know, sentimental reasons? Is this like your grandfather's or something?
No, well,
why is this?
He and I have become friends over the last 8 or 9, 10 years. Instead of going out and going to bars or something, we just hang in and create instead. And so it just happened to be the right moment at the right time this time.
I realized at this point I made a terrible mistake.
Matt!
I was playing very bad organ.
Matt!
And I needed a way.
The first couple of Desert Sessions felt like the full length of my wingspan, but now these are built on top of the older previous volumes, and it really has helped to create a much broader wingspan that's pulling from farther and wider than ever before, you know. It's a wonderful thing even to just sit there and watch two people that never would have played together bonding and giggling and conspiring over something, tinkering on the same art machine, you know. So it's wonderful to watch. You know, It's a really blessed thing to be able to do this for a living for any length of time, and there's no guarantee. I always wait for someone to ring my doorbell and say, we've all agreed we don't like your music anymore, you have to go. And I think I would probably say, okay, well, that was good, that was a long time, thank you. You know, I think music is a lot like bowling. You don't have to be good at it to enjoy it. And it really is the expression where words kind of fail to communicate how you feel. Music really does this wonderful job of that. It's the only thing I know of that's never wrong. You may not like some style of music, but it isn't wrong, you know? And so it's been very helpful for me to leave tough things behind and find things that are worth following and chasing.
Joshua Hami's Desert Sessions, Volumes 11 and 12 is now available for streaming. And that is it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We will see you back here tomorrow.